billions of dollars. And I can tell you right now, give me that billions of dollars and I can save, like, this next month more lives than if we had eliminated every entry on the Wikipedia entry for list of massacres in Canada through time, including the ones done by the government.
I'm sure there's lots of ways money could save lives, but what would you do to deal with gun deaths and mass shootings in Canada? Like, should we do nothing or is there a better plan? What's the better plan?
If you want to cut firearm homicides in Canada, fix our drug policy. And what I mean is, you know, I'm full bore on this. I would say go and legalize, because then at that point, most of the gun violence in Canada is related to the fact that we've banned certain things that are of high value. So we've taken this entire economy and given it entirely to crime.
I hear you. People use guns to settle problems in drug transactions because, like, they can't call the cops. I understand. But we're still talking about a certain kind of gun violence there. I mean, gun crime in cities would maybe go down if we legalize drugs, yes. But gun crime rates in cities are already going down. The place where gun crime rates are going up is in the rural north. Firearm-related violent crime is now at its highest point since data became available in the year 2000. And I'm going to go ahead and guess that a lot of that gun crime, maybe most of it, is coming not from illegally smuggled handguns that crossed our borders from the States, but from legally purchased long guns, semi-automatic rifles in the rural north, which are the exact kind of firearms that the government just tried to ban. So my question to you is, you've given me, I think, a practical answer to what you would do about gun crime in the context of drug crime. But what, if anything, would you do about mass shootings? Is there anything to be done?
I think the focus on that needs to be on police detection, police response, because what we see in a lot of these cases, certainly the worst cases, are associated with a negligent police response. And that was the case in Polytechnique. That's the case in Nova Scotia. That's the case over and over where you see that the police response is fundamentally poor. So Nova Scotia, they hid from the public what was going on because they didn't want the public to realize that this guy was driving around in a police vehicle, basically. Polytechnique, they sat and waited for a lengthy period, such that the coroner said that it made no difference what kind of firearm he had, because he could have been using a musket that he had to, you know, that because they left the guy.
Come on.
This is the coroner who said it doesn't matter if he has a bolt action firearm, because the police took so long to respond that he had lengthy periods.
But it just defies logic what you're saying. If somebody comes into a school with the intention of killing as many people as possible, if they have to reload, if they have to cock the rifle versus just spraying a room full of people with bullets, one is much more dangerous. That's the point of a semi-automatic, is that it kills much more efficiently. That's the point.
I would disagree that that's the point. When you look at Uvalde, is another of these examples where, had the police followed what should be the response, and in fact is supposed to be the official response, they would have saved a ton of lives. But instead, they sat and waited. And so it didn't matter, you know, in terms of the type of firearm in that circumstance, because what ended up driving it is the police sitting there for a very lengthy period. You know, you've got the video of the cop there working the hand sanitizer. And in the case of the Nova Scotia incident, we could have had that as zero if the police had actually responded to the people who reported this ahead of time, going, this guy's dangerous, this guy's got a grudge, this guy's got all of these, you know, issues going on, and he's got illegal firearms. They could have raided him.
I don't disagree that we need to look at the policing in these situations. I don't disagree that we need to continue to improve media handling of these cases. But when it comes to the legality of semi-automatic rifles and the access to semi-automatic weapons, what I'm hearing is that, in your view, we need fewer restrictions. Is that correct? We need fewer restrictions on the range of weapons available and fewer restrictions on obtaining one.
Well, I haven't said fewer.
Easier access?
Well, I think that the restrictions that we're putting on don't, like these new restrictions, don't actually address where people are being killed. If you want to stop homicides, all of this money could be better spent elsewhere. And you would get a, you know, 10 or more multiplier on your dollars for saving lives from violent crime by putting it into other places. And so the question is, why should we save one person instead of saving 10 people? This is, I think, the fundamental problem, is we're doing this the dumbest ways we can because we're looking at sort of showy events instead of more commonplace ones.
No. That's you're just moving the goalposts. We're not trying. That's not the exercise, is we've got this much money. How do we save as many lives as possible? There is something specific in particular about these crimes that terrifies people and makes life horrifying. And it's okay that there are specific efforts to stop this kind of crime. That's okay. That's a worthwhile pursuit to try to stop the next mass shooting. To say, well, why don't you just put that in healthcare, or why don't you put it into stopping drug-related gun crime, that's the debate you want to have, but it's not the actual issue that's being dealt with. And it's a legitimate issue that's being dealt with. It's okay to try to stop the next mass shooting.
Sure, but it's not okay to say we're going to have more deaths because we're pursuing that instead of pursuing something else. And I mean, what this comes down to is ultimately who dies in which kinds of incidents. Why are we so terrified of these incidents as opposed to people shooting each other on Toronto streets over drugs?
Why are we terrified of mass shootings? You got to ask that question.
Why does it get more attention when somebody dies in a mass shooting, which is a rare cause of death, versus on the reserve?
Versus on the reserve in what instance?
Say, you know, we have gang problems on reserves. We have gang problems in big cities. We have gang problems all over the place. But people are less focused on that because there's issues as to why we focus on these things. And I think that largely it's a question of which lives we value over which ones we don't. So when we're talking about this, you do have to focus on what you're looking at. If you're trying to address vehicle deaths, you're going to want to look at like how many are caused by speeding or, you know, impaired driving, you know, more common things, versus how many are caused by a wheel falling off. Unless that wheel falling off turns out to become a common thing, you're not going to spend billions of dollars on what happens about if you get hit by a wheel in traffic. You know, this is important. And you can say, listen, these are scary, these are terrifying, but that doesn't mean that the people are worth more.
Of course it doesn't. Of course it doesn't.
But then the problem is if we're going to spend all of our attention on that.
We're not spending all of our attention on it. We're just spending some of our attention on it. These are all false constructs.
We're spending a disproportionate amount of attention.
We may be spending a disproportionate amount of attention because there is something specific about these crimes. Mass shootings are fascinating to us because they are terrifying, because they are random and chaotic. We are less afraid of crime-related, drug-related gun deaths because those of us who are not involved in that kind of industry feel like it's very unlikely that we're going to be a victim to it. But the fact that every now and then somebody just starts killing their neighbors or targeting a group of people because they're women or because they're Muslim is absolutely horrifying. Or the fact that sometimes a shooter goes into a school, it makes people feel unsafe fundamentally because of the randomness and the chaos and the hate of that. That's why we're fascinated, and that's why we're trying to figure out what the hell we can do about it. And those are not wrong impulses.
There's going to be costs. Like, if they're going in and they're trying to take every SKS from the reserves, there's going to be people who are killed in that. That's going to be a straight-up cost to that. You can't send that many boots at people. I'm sorry, the police are sending guns. Like, when you're saying we want to send the police to do these things, you're wanting to send violent people with firearms to accomplish a task. And that has predictable results.
I'm open to all solutions, including a conversation about whether cops should have these weapons as well.
fundamentally, when we look at the history of Indigenous rights in Canada, I'll bring up OCA, because I'm one of the people who thinks it's a good thing that the OCA golf course didn't get expanded. And I can tell you that had the Indigenous people there been disarmed, it would be a golf course right now. And we'd probably have Trudeau there doing fundraisers and doing a land acknowledgement on land stolen from the Mohawk. When you look at that protest was not cleared in large part because it was armed.
Hi, I'm Naomi Sayers. I'm an Indigenous woman lawyer, criminal defense lawyer as well. I am a firearms owner. I have my restricted license and I do shooting with restricted firearms. So I represent individuals charged with a number of offenses, some of which include firearms offenses. Current firearms legislation is a very urban-centric approach to firearm safety. It's totally devoid of the northern and rural context. In terms of, you know, domestic violence survivors, particularly in northern and rural regions, even the Canadian Association Chiefs of Police have gone out and said the weapon of choice in those situations are hunting rifles, not handguns, when a domestic violence survivor is experiencing violence in the home. And we know that against Indigenous people in rural areas as well, right? I think that those realities are completely devoid of those contexts. And the people who put it together obviously have no idea how firearms work, have no idea. And I 100% bet that they probably never shot a firearm in their entire lives. So when I moved home back from Toronto, one of the first things I did was I went and got my firearms license because I knew that I wanted to help individuals. That's a way of life up here. You know at least somebody who owns firearms, whether it's sport or hunting. It is sad when you have a large metropolitan city with a lot of gun violence, but to overlay it and apply it across the country, you're missing out on the reality in terms of rural and northern ways of life. The amendments, I think, that happened in August, withdrawn about 2-3 weeks ago, it over-captured some of those common use hunting rifles. So I lived and worked in northern Alberta, an hour south of the Northwest Territory borders. And during their hunting and fishing season, their community hunted for the entire community. So it wasn't hunting, you know, for your family, it was they would hunt and they would bring back enough meat and sustenance for the community. They would distribute it to the elders. They would distribute it to families in need. They would take care of it. They would have feasts and they would use whatever little bit was left for ceremony. Obviously, we have to ask, how did they kill the moose? Well, you know, hunting rifles. And that's the reality. Indigenous nations feel unheard. Indigenous nations are pushed to the wayside, and that's exactly what this legislation is doing.
Should I take from this then, Ian, that you are of the mind, and I know that this is a popular concept amongst many gun advocates, that an armed population is a population that is in a better position to advocate for its rights, and that there are benefits to our democracy to have an armed population, and that itself is a goal. Is that a position that you take?
To an extent, I agree with Orwell when he said that the rifle above the fireplace in a worker's cottage is something to be preserved, that it's an element of liberty. And I encourage people to look at the history of union struggles, to look at the history of you know, again, Indigenous pushback against some of the look at the history of the U.S. civil rights movement.
It was good that people had guns in these instances, is what you're saying. I'm glad that we got here, because I think that when we just talk about hunting and sport shooting, it can obscure the fact that there is an ideology at play, and it is one about preserving your rights by having an armed population. And that, you know, at least let's know where you stand with that.
There's groups in the U.S. right now who are seeking to do violence, especially to the trans community. And as a response, the trans community, at least a portion of them, have focused on, we need to also be armed.
Uh-huh.
And there have been numerous instances where people have shown up to do violence to those communities and have been repelled. people who are oppressed can't necessarily rely on the system that is oppressing them. And that becomes a consideration, at least.
I see the future you project of hundreds of armed special interest militias, and it scares the living shit out of me, Ian.
The problem is that you have the people who wish to do wrong and who are inclined to violate the laws are able to arm themselves without too much difficulty. And I will give you an even scarier future, which is, in the near future, you won't be able to stop people from having firearms by any means of control, because it's becoming far too easy to create a firearm out of nothing, and the tools for that are going to become easier and easier and easier. Improvised firearms have always been a thing in Canada and in the States, but the quality of them is going to increase to a degree that makes them indistinguishable.
The media loved the story about the ghost guns, print them at home with a 3D printer.
This will soon be a ghost gun. An untraceable firearm with no serial number anywhere on it. Homemade in just a few hours using a 3D printer. Police across Canada are worried. More than 100 were seized nationwide.
Have you ever dealt with coyotes attacking your livestock?
Not in a month, at least. No, I've never dealt with coyotes.
You can't make a statement that there are no costs, that this is something that is basically a freebie or a gimme, when you don't understand those people that are going to be affected.
But affected how? Like, can you point me to the case where the guy shot the coyote, but he didn't have a semi, so he got mauled? Like, does that exist? Has that happened?
It's not got mauled. You know, if you're dealing with predators who are going after your livestock, you're trying to deal with a group that is, you know, and so the ability to make follow-up shots and get multiple coyotes is important.
But you just go pow, chick, chick, pow, chick, chick, pow. It's okay.
And have you ever done that with coyotes?
You know, not in many moons.
I'm guessing never.
No, never.
So, I mean, the problem is coyotes will scatter, right? And so the difference between 5 and 3 is significant when you're talking about, you know, coyotes scattering.
I think that there's a lack of good faith debate, because when I hear the argument about feral hogs or coyotes or these practical considerations and the practical reason for needing semi-automatics, I don't believe you, because I think that what you're really concerned about is an ideological argument about your fundamental human rights being intrinsically linked to your right to bear arms. And I think that that's actually what you care about.
I'm a firearms lawyer, right? So I end up dealing with all sorts of issues in terms of who has firearms. And that could be anything from, you know, the guy who gets busted because he's, you know, a bad guy dealing drugs and has firearms. But I also talk to, you know, and I can tell you, there's like my comments on OCA, and saying that it's a good thing that it's not a golf course, there's plenty of people with semi-automatics who would think that those are, that I'm way off on that.
I know. It's all you people with semi-automatics can sometimes disagree with each other, and that's what concerns me so. As a final question for you, is there any kind of gun that you think should be banned?
Bans as a, right now in Canada, civilians can theoretically own just about any kind of gun under certain circumstances. You could potentially own a heavy machine gun. And if you're wondering who could own a heavy machine gun and why would they do it, movie armorers is the category that would apply to. If you go and see, for instance, Movie Armaments Group, they have a collection of firearms, some of which would surprise you because we film things. When was the last time that a film armorer committed a crime in Canada? Basically never that I know of.
So it sounds like a no. It sounds like the answer is a no. You don't think that there's any weapon that should be banned completely.
I think that we can have a real discussion on what kind of regulations to impose on which kinds of firearms. You know, if we look at, say, a Vegas-style range where you can go and rent a full-auto gun at the range and shoot it there, I don't see an issue with that. I'm fundamentally a pragmatic guy. And when I say I'm a pragmatic guy, like, I am pragmatic to the extent of I think we should legalize drugs to solve some of these violence issues. That's my kind of level of pragmatism about this. And so I think give me any solution, so long as it's a solution that looks like it's going to do something about the real problems and not one that looks like it's driven by emotion.
Thank you, Ian.
So, oh, no problem.
That's your Canada Land for the week. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. We're on Twitter at CanadaLand. Our website is at canadaland.com. Tristan Capicchione is our audio editor and our technical producer. Additional production and reporting on this episode by Cassidy Villabrin-Barakis. Our managing editor is Annette Ejiofor. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Lisa Taylor, professor, journalist, lawyer, joining us from Halifax. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Welcome to Shortcuts, Lisa, where we talk about the news.
I am here for it. Thank you.
You're here for our 400th episode. Dear God, that is a lot of takes.
That is an awful lot. Thank you for your service.
Anything I can do to help. Lisa, here on Shortcuts, we want to duly note stories that might otherwise escape people's attention. What do you have to duly note today?
I would like to duly note a story from Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, the birthplace of Confederation, you may have heard. Not a fiercely democratic place at the moment, not city council there, since we're talking about city councils. City council in Charlottetown, there's been an analysis of public records done that says it has spent more time in in-camera meetings, closed-door meetings, than open sessions of council this year. It's probably in violation of the Municipal Government Act of the province, and it seems like the bar is set tremendously low in Charlottetown in terms of what will trigger an in-camera meeting.
Duly noted, and there's so many ways that we could measure as journalism dies, government secrecy just gets more and more secrety. I want to duly note an update on a story that we first talked about like 3 years ago. The Toronto police were getting into podcasting. They're commissioning Copaganda, branded podcasts about the police by the police. And those podcasts have been coming out. Let's hear a little bit.
Welcome to 24 Shades of Blue Missing Persons Edition. I'm your host, Andy O'Brien. On July 30, 1985, 8-year-old Nicole Moran left her parents' apartment in Etobicoke to meet a friend in the lobby for a swim. That day, she never met with her friend and has been missing ever since.
All right. What I want to duly note is not anything qualitative about that podcast. I'll hold my tongue.
Right.
What I want to duly note is not the recent revelation that CBC Toronto reported that the Toronto police spent $337,000 on that podcast series from OB and Axe. That's the production house. And the CBC had really interesting email communications from the cops where the cops said, Andy O'Brien from OBOX is a character with mad skills in startups. He runs the cool podcast I showed you the deck on. These are the cops planning their podcast game. I'm not duly noting how lame that is, nor that they got ripped off and they spent way too much on that podcast. What I want to duly note is that now, when I get murdered and the cops fail to find my killer, I don't only have to worry about like murderinos and, you know, basement crime podcasts capitalizing on my death, but the goddamn police who failed to solve my murder are now going to be releasing podcasts about how they f***ed up and couldn't find my killer. That's what I want to duly note.
Duly noted. One more story from the Maritimes. It is about a well-known food product here. Don't guess it yet. I just want to set you up here a bit and tell you. Jesse, have you ever played Spelling Bee? It's the New York Times game.
As a matter of fact, I have.
Hey, you ever been Queen Bee?
No, I have not.
Okay, you will. You'll get there. Anyhow, so Spelling Bee is like the lesser-known cousin to Wordle, but infinitely more fun, I would suggest. It has broken the hearts of Maritimers, and you want to get behind this one because I know you're not doing so well on the West Coast, so why don't you try the Best Coast? I know you're never going to stop the shame of that one. Spelling Bee did not, on February 13th, recognize the word donaire. It has decided that donaire is a word too obscure or perhaps offensive to show up among its results. Halifax is pissed.
Lisa, you are aware of where donaires come from, are you not?
The donaire comes from Bedford, Nova Scotia in the 1970s, because this is no doner kebab.
Oh, we're making a distinction. This is the saddest part of being Canadian. This is like when Canadians are like, it's a Muskoka chair. It's an Adirondack chair.
No, this is another thing.
A donaire is not an East. It's Turkish. It's somebody else's thing. You can't just...
No, it's not as cool as a doner kebab, okay?
Because you put sweet mayo on it?
And you make it with beef. You make it with beef, and then you take... It is the most unholy alliance of maritime ingredients. You take sweetened condensed milk, mix it with some vinegar and powdered garlic to make a sauce.
I'm so embarrassed for you. Duly noted.
I'd rather have the doner kebab, but, you know, it's my birthright.
Lisa Taylor, that is Shortcuts this week. Thank you for joining me.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
We can be found on Twitter at Canada Land. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that people send. Lisa, where can people find you?
They can find me nowhere these days because I'm off the Twitter and not on the Mastodon.
Do you want to be found?
Do I even know if I exist if I'm not on one of those platforms? You can find me on faculty profile page at TMU or University of King's College.
You can find Lisa on her Vespa scooter. She won the door prize at the Stag and Doe.
100%.
Tooling around Halifax. This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ejiofor. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.
This is Eboshi from Cartel Madras, and you're listening to CJSF.
I was on the back of your mind. I was on the back of your lap. You were in the back of the car. You were in the back of my heart. I was in the back of the bar. You know what I do, take things too far. Don't know where to start or begin. Don't know how it ends. Don't know how to say what I meant. Don't know how to say how I feel. Baby, is it real? I was like 34 double Ds. You know what I like. Ice cold.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Burnaby, BC.
Is that a normal part of your singing?
That's the way I've always sung. This is my song.
Are there subliminal duets?
Absolutely not.
The Metal Meltdown. A show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. Melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Studio 6, CJSF's video series, captures high-quality video recordings of live performances.
So, you've released some demos now, that titled, coincidentally, Demos.
It's just called Demos right now, yeah.
And interviews with impactful and inspiring artists.
Well, we're going to go on a tour. Okay, we're playing Sled Island, which will be sick. We're very excited for that.
Music Waste.
And we're playing Music Waste, also very excited for that. So that makes it easy. And I think we're going to probably record soon.
As well as engaging conversations with community members about the issues that are most important to their communities. Watch all of the Studio 6 live sessions on CJSF's YouTube page or on our website at cjsf.ca/studio6.